Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The real story is the people, of course, but the economic impact of the earthquake in Japan is spreading. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday, today the 14th of March. Good to have you with us. There is no gripping way to try to set up the news from Japan today. The pictures and videos we all saw over the weekend have pretty much already done that. Rob Schmitz is in Tokyo for us. He got there overnight. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So it is, as we speak, the middle of the night. You have just arrived in Tokyo. Give me a sense of how things are going. What's it like there?
Well, you know, the first thing I saw when I got out of customs at the airport was this enormous line of people that seemed to go on forever. I mean, it took me about 10 minutes to walk the length of it and just listen a moment to the police officers patrolling this line. So I followed one of the officers to the front of the line, and I realized it was a line for the express train that usually whisks passengers from the Tokyo and Narita airport into the city. It usually takes about an hour, and you know, this was not the case today. I mean, the train was completely shut down, and a slower one was barely operating. But the folks in line didn't really need the police there. What's interesting is that the Japanese have this strong sense of dignity in times of crisis like this, and the line was pretty orderly.
What's your sense, though, Rob, about how people feel about how the government's handling things overall?
Well, I think folks that I've talked to so far are a little confused about some of the mixed messages regarding some of the nuclear reactor stuff. But you know, another thing that people are even more worried about, you know, are the supply chains, because you know, I talked a little bit about when I was at the airport. You know, when I decided to actually buy a ticket for a bus because I wasn't going to wait in that line for a train. And I called my friend in Tokyo while I was there at the airport, and she told me that food was running out in Tokyo, and that I should buy some food at the airport. And that was just mind-boggling to me. You know, this is Tokyo, and so I called another person I knew in Tokyo to do a reality check on that, and he confirmed it. He told me that his local grocery stores, which in Tokyo tend to be these mom-and-pop stores, he told me that all these stores are running out of bread and rice. And in fact, when I tried to buy something to eat at Narita, almost the entire menu was crossed off at the restaurant I went to, and all they had were hot dogs. You know, so here we have one of the largest, most developed cities on Earth, famous for its food and efficient transportation, and both of these things are starting to run on empty.
And it's quite a ways from Sendai, the area hardest hit. Are you going to try to get up there, I imagine?
Well, you know, I'm going to try, here's the problem. The people that have tried in you know, the recent day or two have run out of gas. Many journalists are stuck between Tokyo and Sendai because their drivers couldn't find any gas. You know, gas is being rationed throughout the country, as is water and electricity. You know, these are the things that make an economy tick. And in Japan, they're running out. And that means the entire supply chain that serves not only the northeast of this country, where it was hardest hit, but the other big cities in this country is being cut off.
Rob Schmitz in Tokyo for us today. Rob, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Rob is talking supply chains in the domestic context there, getting food and fuel from one place to another within Japan. But if you were to take apart your smartphone or your new iPad 2 or your big screen TV, you'll find things, many things, surely, that were made in Japan. Japanese factories supply a big chunk of the world with memory chips and silicon wafers and semiconductors. And today, the economic effects of Friday's earthquake are starting to be felt in markets and on manufacturing floors. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Japan is a huge player in the global semiconductor market. The country makes roughly 60% of all the silicon wafers that are used in semiconductors around the world. Immediately after the quake on Friday, semiconductor plants more than 500 miles away from the epicenter shut their operations. That's like a quake in Richmond, Virginia, knocking out factories north of Boston, or one in San Diego, shuttering factories in the suburbs of San Francisco.
It's not necessarily just what's been damaged, but it's what has had to be shut down just because there is some question as to whether or not there's a problem.
Jim Handy follows the semiconductor market for the firm Objective Analysis. He estimates about a dozen semiconductor plants have probably been knocked out of production, at least temporarily. If that were the end of the story, Dean Freeman, a semiconductor analyst at Gartner, wouldn't be that concerned.
A bigger issue for Japan is the overall power situation. Right now, you know, they're shutting the power off for 8 hours a day. So that means that the semiconductor plants are going to have to figure out how to work around the power outages.
Fabricating chips is a precise, energy-intensive business.
If you're in the middle of a process at 1200 degrees C and you have to shut the power down before you're done, there's going to be an impact.
If events in Japan keep silicon wafer factories or semiconductor plants offline for more than a week or two, it could cause chip shortages around the world. Manufacturers of everything, from automobiles to iPads, might have to wait or simply pay more to get the semiconductors they need. And Hardy's predicting big price spikes. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There was a second explosion today at the damaged Fukushima nuclear reactor complex. A third reactor there is in danger of overheating. And it kind of goes without saying that nuclear power companies around the world are watching nervously. Already today, Switzerland and Germany have canceled or suspended plans to build new plants. All of this comes as public support for nuclear power had been growing. Yeah, I said had. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Switzerland halted plans to build and replace nuclear plants. Germany today made a similar announcement. The chairman of India's state-run nuclear company plans to, quote, revisit the entire thing. Add it all up, and here's what it means to industry consultant Alan Madian.
Let's do a gut check and see what's going on here and see whether we have to take radical action or whether we can get through this, is what I'm hearing.
He's watching global public reaction. If it's strong, governments could pull critical subsidies to nuclear power. History says it could go either way.
You know, Three Mile Island basically eliminated nuclear construction in the United States for three decades. Now, on the other hand, Chernobyl didn't slow the Russians down very much.
Median says Russia is still a nuclear growth market, plus India, South Korea, and China, which is building 23 plants. The U.S. is building just five. Harvard fellow William Tobey once ran the government's largest nuclear proliferation program. He expects regulators to reassess reactor risk. They need power for cooling, and Japan shows a single disaster can cut the first line of power, the grid, as well as the backup, diesel generators.
The lesson is what may appear to be one in a million odds, because they seem like independent probabilities, may not be.
It could bring new regulations. Several U.S. nuclear energy companies saw their stocks fall today. Domestically, more than 100 reactors crank out power now. But the White House wants subsidies for more, since nuclear is ultra-low carbon. And late this afternoon at the White House, regulators argued it's safe. Gregory Yasko chairs the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Bottom line, right now, we believe that the plants in this country continue to be designed to a very high standard for seismic and tsunami-type events.
Incidentally, at the Diablo Canyon plant in California, local officials asked for extra seismic studies for safety. They asked last March, almost a year to the day before this disaster. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott hinted at this, but pretty much anything having to do with nuclear power was lower on Wall Street today. Uranium companies, nuclear companies, even General Electric, which designed one of the Fukushima reactors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United States is dipping a diplomatic toe into the situation in Libya. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's in Paris today, where she is set to meet with members of the Libyan opposition. Tomorrow, the secretary is going to be in Cairo to see firsthand what's happening there, although she didn't necessarily have to go all that way. Every year, Egypt pays American lobbyists more than $1 million to represent its interests to the White House, to Capitol Hill, and corporate boardrooms. Hearing that, we sent Marketplace's David Gura off in search of the answer to this question. For that kind of money, what does a foreign government get?
Image work, for starters. A few years ago, the PLM group put together a campaign for its client called Take a Second Look at Egypt.
The communications part of our team distributed, I don't know, hundreds of postcard-shaped messages saying, did you know this fact about Egypt?
That's lobbyist and former Congressman Toby Moffat, the M in the PLM group. The Egyptian embassy sent those cards to influential people who might not know that say, Cairo is home to Africa's only subway system. Moffitt created the PLM Group in 2007 with Tony Podesta and another former congressman, Bob Livingston, to be lobbyists for Egypt. Before then, Graham Bannerman was the country's point man in Washington.
Well, I fundamentally believe that you really shouldn't have to have lobbyists. But the problem is our system of government is so complicated and decisions are so strange, you know, that sometimes you need somebody to guide you through the system.
Lobbyists brief embassy staff. They set up meetings with Americans from the government and from businesses, including defense contractors. Bill Allison is with the Sunlight Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for more transparent lobbying.
You know, they do all kinds of different things to try to get these people together and talking, because it's once you start talking, then you make deals.
During the first Gulf War, for example, Bannerman lobbied hard to get Egypt's foreign debts forgiven. How'd he do it? He invited a few dozen congressional and administration staffers to join him for lunch.
When the Iraqis invaded Kuwait and the president said, what can we do to help the Egyptians out? Two of the people in that meeting wrote the memo that said, forgive their debt.
New rules have put an end to the Bannerman brown bag. But Egypt's lobbying team went into action last year, helping to organize opposition to a Senate resolution supporting democracy, human rights, and civil liberties in Egypt, just before elections there. Sarah Margon was a foreign policy advisor to one of its sponsors, Senator Russ Feingold. She described the resolution.
We recognize the critical importance of Egypt in the region. We recognize the critical importance of maintaining our relationship, but we also think it's in both the Egyptians' interest and our own interest for them to start making serious democratic reforms.
It had support from Democrats and Republicans, but over the summer, Margon says, that started to change.
There was an Egyptian delegation that flew in from Cairo to protest against it. My understanding is that the Secretary of State was asked about it on phone calls.
Lobbyists had questions for Margon. Then, she says, they tried to slow things down.
Let's not overstate what the consultants did here.
Toby Moffitt acknowledges he lobbied against the resolution, but he says many senators decided it was imprudent. They were concerned it could derail efforts to restart peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians, and Congress's summer recess was approaching.
This was in good measure the Senate running out of time, first of all, and secondly, the Senate saying, you know, why are we doing this right now?
Margon, the Senate aide, came away with a different take.
In the end, the resolution didn't move, but it was not because the clock ran out.
In the end, the clock did run out on anti-democratic forces in Egypt. So I asked Toby Moffitt how Egypt's story, the one he's paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to tell and sell, has changed. The PLM group landed on its feet after the revolution. The military controls the country, and the defense ministry is one of the group's clients.
Let's put it this way. We look forward to having more positive things to talk about in addition to all the positive things we have had to talk about.
Moffitt says he's on Capitol Hill and on the phone every day talking to his Egyptian clients, giving suggestions. Like so many people, he's had to take a second look at Egypt. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new generation takes binoculars in hand.
This isn't your grandmother's Audubon anymore.
But first, let's do the numbers. Lingering worries over the aftermath of Japan's big earthquake sent U.S. stocks lower today, pushed the blue chips back down below the 12,000 level. The Dow Industrials dropped 51 points, 0.4%, finished at 11,993 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq down 14 points, about 0.5%, closed at an even 2,700. The S&P 500 slid 7 points, 0.6%, wrapped up at 1,296. Concerns about the unstable nuclear facilities in Japan put wind behind the sales of renewable energy companies. Power One surged up 12%. MEMC Electronic Materials rose 11%. On the flip side, Entergy Corporation, which operates nuclear facilities, powered down nearly 5%. Today, GE lost more than 2%. As we told you, it designed one of the reactors at the Japanese facility. Financials were down. Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley all took off more than 1% today. Bond prices rose amid new global worries, lowered the yield on the 10-year to 3.36%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit squarespace.com/marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's squarespace.com/marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
On the Marketplace Date Book, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. In Washington, the Federal Reserve meets on interest rates and the economy. And the Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on Afghanistan. General David Petraeus testifies. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I know out here on the West Coast, there's been a lot of attention paid the past couple of days to disaster preparedness, how we might manage in an earthquake like Japan's. You substitute a different natural disaster, and the same question applies to pretty much the rest of the country, how infrastructure would hold up. The White House says improving roads and pipelines and even broadband networks is a priority. That, in turn, will mean money and lots of it, which is why Washington, in this case, is going to have to make nice with Wall Street. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
This week, Marketplace has learned, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry is likely to introduce a bill to create a national infrastructure bank. The bank would be seeded with government money. But, and this is unusual, its primary purpose would be to get Wall Street to pick up part of the bill for future construction projects. That's a good move, according to Michael Lukosky. He wrote a book called Obama's Bank, Financing a Durable New Deal.
What an infrastructure bank at its core is about, it's about building new things and bringing private capital in to build new things.
Here's how it might work. The government would put in as much as $50 billion. Wall Street would add to that, and it would have a say in investment decisions. The profits would be split proportionally. Bernard Schwartz, a longtime executive, says that $50 billion could quadruple once professional investors add their own funds. America needs $2 trillion just to fix its old roads and water systems. Previous plans to boost public works spending have called on the government to pay for everything, which it can't afford. Schwartz, like other supporters of this idea, sees the infrastructure push as a solution to the nation's unemployment problem.
For every $1 billion of transportation infrastructure that's invested, it's estimated that about 46,000 people are put back to work.
Schwartz believes that several million Americans could get off the unemployment line if Washington and Wall Street can work together on the new bank. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett has a knack for buying companies that make other things work right. He owns Fruit of the Loom, for instance, the underwear company. Think about it. Today, Buffett announced he's spending $9 billion for a company called Lubrizol. It's a specialty chemical company. It's not all that well known. At least it wasn't. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
If the deal goes through, Lubrizol will join the ranks of See's Candy, Dairy Queen, Geico, and Burlington Northern Santa Fe in Buffett's portfolio. $9 billion would make it one of Berkshire Hathaway's biggest buys ever. Never heard of Lubrizol? Well, neither had Morningstar stock analyst Gregory Warren.
It's not one of those sexy companies. They're pretty much selling fluids, specialty lubricants, metalworking fluids, performance coatings, those kind of things.
So maybe not sexy, but very practical, says Warren. Lubrizol does a lot of business with oil companies and refineries, which puts it in a good position as energy demands increase from India and China.
It's necessary for certain businesses. You know, and as the economy recovers, there's always going to be a niche for that business.
Shares of similar companies will probably get a Buffett bump, says Georgetown finance professor James Angel. That's because there's
a small army of Buffett watchers. And, you know, I suspect people are looking at a lot of other specialty chemical companies right now.
After Buffett bought Railroad Burlington Northern in 2009, investors rushed to buy railroad stocks. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Ever since that now ubiquitous gecko showed up on television, insurance companies have been going all out to one-up each other. They've poured something like $4 billion into the advertising battle for your business.
Get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem like me.
Oh, and rename the company Nation Pam. Oh.
Wait!
Maxwell!
Yeah?
You're home.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Mrs. A.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
I like that squealing pig one myself. Today, Progressive Insurance launched a new nationwide ad campaign, hoping its approach will prove to be a game changer. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains that could depend on how much of your privacy you're willing to give up.
Up to now, it's been a battle of the various insurance ad personalities. Now, Progressive is rolling out what it sees as a kind of secret weapon, one that could give drivers nearly a third off their premiums. Enter the company's perky TV sales clerk, Flo.
This little baby keeps track of your great driving habits so you can save money.
Amazing.
She's holding a cell phone-sized gizmo that plugs into the car's data port. It calls the company with a regular snapshot of driving habits, from how aggressively the car is driven to whether it's being used during riskier early morning hours. Richard Hutchinson helped develop the program.
It's purely voluntary, you know, so if you think it's something that could help you and something of interest, we offer it. And, you know, our view is if it's not of interest, you know, it's not something we're going to require of you.
The new ads paint the snapshot device as a way for customers to control insurance costs. But at the Center for Auto Safety, Director Clarence Ditlow suggests the companies have a different motivation for attracting better drivers.
For the insurance companies, it's clear. They pay out less in losses for the premiums that they take in.
Progressive vows it won't use the data to decide accident claims, but privacy advocates worry what the information could be used for.
Progressive obviously is limited in terms of what they can promise.
Paul Stevens heads the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse.
When you give this information up, it can be used in ways that you might not anticipate, which you might not have control over.
Stevens warns it could figure into a case against you made by, say, a private party suing for damages. And Progressive's ads don't mention that. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 48 million Americans consider themselves birders, people for whom a good walk outdoors isn't complete without a pair of binoculars and a guidebook in hand. Former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is one of them, for what it's worth. And all in all, birding is a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry. But as you may have noticed the last time he was on TV, Henry Paulson is no spring chicken. And in fact, the folks at the Audubon Society are scratching their heads and asking themselves, why are our members so not young? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill has the story.
It's a crisp winter morning in Los Angeles, and I'm out searching, not for the noisy goldfinch or the soaring red-tailed hawk, but for something much rarer. Wait! Hush! There she is, a young birder.
Celeste Prince.
Okay, my apologies to all you David Attenborough fans out there. But Celeste Prince is exactly the sort of birder the Audubon Society is hoping to find. She's in her 30s and is a musician here in L.A. She looks the part, with long red hair and dressed for a hike in a stylish coat and boots. Prince seems really, truly into birdwatching.
I get made fun of a lot by my brothers for it. There's times when I'm chasing a mountain quail through the backyard and they're all looking at each other going, oh my gosh, what is happening right now?
Prince has her iPad with her, with an application that helps her ID birds and make bird sounds. Something that can be a bit problematic, especially when she demonstrates by playing the call of a Cooper's hawk. And so now are thousands of birds freaked out that they've just heard a hawk?
Yes.
Gary George has been birding for 20 plus years.
Now you'll see that it gets very quiet. Because Cooper's hawks actually eat birds.
Probably not the right bird to choose for this particular moment.
George is with California Audubon. He says Cooper's hawk style mistakes aside, new birders and their technology are welcome. Organizations need to keep appealing to new generations to stay relevant.
This isn't your grandmother's Audubon anymore.
David Yarnold is the president of the National Audubon Society. He says they're trying out the new image in California, using social media to attract new people.
A younger, more diverse audience to help us create the Audubon of the future. And it's already paying off enormously in California.
Over 300 people RSVP'd to an Audubon-sponsored party at an art gallery in Venice Beach. Most of the partiers aren't members. And, says Grant Krishom, executive director of California Audubon, that's not what this event, or even this rebrand, is about.
For Audubon, it's not so much about building membership per se.
for us, it's really about finding ways to connect people with the work we do, but also connecting people with each other.
He's hoping people will connect over an interest in nature, and maybe even get out and do something about it. His timing seems good. If you think about it, there are already a whole lot of younger people who are trying out other, older generation pastimes. Once fuddy-duddy hobbies like knitting and canning are cool, why not birding? USC marketing professor Ira Kolb says the pull to simpler things, especially for young adults, makes sense.
Yeah, we're all gone crazy by doing too many things. You know, the computer's going and the emails are coming in.
Kalp thinks that need for calm could work in Audubon's favor as it tries to make birding and the outdoors appealing to a younger crowd. But there's a bit of a risk.
You don't want to alienate your most loyal customers. And that might be the grandmas or the grandpas.
The trick is finding the right message that'll bring everyone in. So what do the birds think of all the fuss? I tried to ask, but they were too freaked out by the Cooper's hawk sound to make a peep. Maybe next time. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, because sometimes the news just falls right into your lap.
Aflac!
Following up on Bob Moon's story about insurance companies doing whatever they can to get your business, the disability insurer Aflac fired that duck today, or rather the voice thereof. Comedian Gilbert Gottfried had been quacking for Aflac since 2000. He was let go over some jokes he tweeted about the earthquake and the tsunami. And as if that wasn't bad enough, Japan is Aflac's most important market. Gets about 3/4 of its revenue there, although they do use a different voice in Japanese ads. And on that note, that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 51 points, 4/10 of 1%, 11,993 at the close. The NASDAQ down 14 points, about 0.5%, 2,700. The S&P 500 off 7 points, 6/10 of 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, dictators hide their money in a lot of places, you know, including London's wealthiest neighborhoods.
I'm a bit uncomfortable to live next door to the mass murderer or a serial killer.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.